Welcome to Discovery 2, Module 5, Part 2. And then we're going to go on to some of Module 6, depending on how we're feeling, because these are pretty heavy modules. I actually prefer to go through less material per week and actually take, say, 13, 14 weeks to go through, rather than go through one module a week and bombard you all with 10 weeks of absolute unhappiness. So if anybody wants me to go faster, I can, but I think there's probably enough in these lectures to keep you all pretty busy. Okay, just a bit of revision from last week. We have set up host names and passwords, very important. The reason you set the host name on the router is so that you know which one you're telneted into. As I explained, the host name comes up in the prompt. So, for example, if the router host name was DropBear, you would have a prompt of DropBear number or DropBear greater if you are in user exec mode as opposed to privilege exec mode. Remember, we talked about the prompts last week, and we said that the character on the end of your prompt changes depending on which mode you are in, and we almost have the remote bundle functional. Once that is functional, you can go in and look at those prompts. And what you'll find is that the prompt actually changes. If you are lucky enough to have a Braille display, this will make your life a lot easier. And you can actually see the prompts. Just give me a second.
You can see which ones we skip by looking at the...
Okie dokie. Now, remember we talked about the enable password and the enable secret. Now, the enable password is in clear text by default and will show up if you do a show running config, whereas the enable secret is usually encrypted. If you want to put a weak password encryption on the enable password, then you want to run a service password - encryption. However, it is a weak password, and there are a whole stack of hacks or script kiddie tools that you can get off Darknet for breaking that weak encryption on the enable password, so don't rely on it. There is a login banner, which is shown when you log into the router, and that should say things. That should say things along the lines of, if you unauthorized access is prohibited, accessing this router is a $50,000 fine and 5 years in jail, yada yada yada, under the Crimes Act 1913, blah blah blah. So you can Google yourself up some sort of. There's a pretty standard message you put on, which basically says you'll get into lots of trouble if you hack into our router. The banner message of the day is shown after you log in, so it contains messages such as router downtime will be on Thursday between 6 and 8 p.m. while we all go to the pub. But you don't put that on the login banner because you don't want hackers see the login banners. You don't see the message of the day until you have finished actually logging in. Okay, we talked about synchronous logging, which was where the logging actually comes up in the middle of what you're typing, and that can be very disruptive if you're using a screen reader, because yes, the router is going to keep doing things even if you're sitting waiting at the router prompt. Now, that panics a lot of people because they don't expect the router to continue to do things while they're sitting there. So you can turn off synchronous logging so that it only comes up when you're sitting at a command prompt as opposed to whenever it feels like putting it up. You can still keep typing, it's just a bit disconcerting to have your log input break up what is on your screen. Any questions about that so far?
No.
Anyone still awake?
I'm here.
Yes.
Jolly good. Okay. When you are consoling into a router, you're not actually telling it that everything is going to be okay. You're actually connecting out of the out-of-band management port, and you're using a serial cable. Some of the routers have USB ports on them. Do the USB ports work yet, Ian, or not yet? On the Cisco routers? No? They still don't work? Not for console. Oh, okay. Well, Oh, you can use them for flash upgrade, but not for console. So you're still using serial ports, which is a 9 or 25-pin connector. Well, on the router, it's an RJ45, but on your PC, it's a 9 or 25-pin connector. And it's an RJ45 on the router, and it is a rollover cable. And that will be in one of your exams. What are you doing on, Marcus? Okay. And you can connect it to your PC using terminal emulation software. We recommend TerraTab. 4.63 is the latest version of that. We'll have to go and pull that down and put it up on the website a little bit later today. 4.60 is what we've got up there, and you will need to install and compile the JAWS script and set your cursor to either a vertical or horizontal line. Basically, you follow the instructions in the setting up TerraTerm text file. And morbid curiosity, have you managed to get that to work, Scott? Have you tried getting that working?
Yep. I haven't got anything to test it with here, but I've got TerraTerm working in the past. With JAWS 11, they're doing a whole heap of stuff with secure, terminal windows and things like that, so it'll be interesting to see how it works.
I will be very unhappy if they break our TerraTerm support, because that would be very sad. Secure CRT costs real money, and although if they make PuTTY work, we'll be happy campers.
Okay, I've heard that working.
Yeah, it does work to a large extent. I'm not sure whether it works quite as seamlessly as TerraTerm. I think if you're using secure CRT, you've got to set it to say all, and it basically reads the whole screen when there's a little refresh, which can be a bit annoying sometimes.
But there's scripts for secure CRT that fix that.
Ah, excellent. All right, so if you want to use secure CRT and you've got far too much money, go buy it. I think it's also only a timed license, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. It's something like 100 US or something. It's a bit painful, and I think that's per year, I don't know.
Okay, I did hear somebody talking about how they'd got PuTTY working with JAWS, but I'm not sure how well.
It's all right, this is all relevant to the lecture anyway.
Yeah, it is. That's what I was talking about, because it is all relevant. The more options you've got, the better you are. Obviously GRML and a Linux boot disk is also a Linux boot thumb drive or boot CD is an excellent way of accessing these terminal things, but you won't have access to the regular Windows stuff. Although, believe it or not, GRML does run in a virtual machine, so that's another solution that you could also run if you were looking to be a different sort of person. All of that sort of stuff works fairly well. We have tended to standardise on TerraTerm because it's what I use and it works. But if anybody's got any other solutions that work for them, please let us know, and we'll look at providing other options. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. So he can... Yes, all right, Marcus. We'll talk to you later. That's fine.
I'll advocate TerraTerm too.
It's not bad, is it?
I use just about every day of the week to get into a number of different Linux machines, and I've got a couple of screens in front of me now on it.
And the scrollback buffers even kind of work with speech. You can scroll back and then use a JAWS
cursor. Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Yeah, you can use a JAWS cursor to go back. Yeah, it's a ripper. And you can output to a log, I think. I think it's on the file menu.
Now, that's a very important point, actually. You should know how to output to a log, because I need log output to prove that you students did the Discovery 2 labs. So you go file logging ... and you start logging, and it opens up another window, and you do your stuff, and then you can go stop logging in the log button, or you can pause the logging and restart the logging. And I would appreciate it if students would edit irrelevant information out of the log file. I do not need to see you mistype show running config 6 times. And believe me, it has happened.
Oh, man. So edit out your typos. Yeah, exactly.
Pretty much. I don't need to see show running config or show rumming config was another one I saw. I mean, I don't know whether they were rumming at the time, but obviously...
Yeah, rum must have had a part.
Yeah, that's right. So obviously we'd like to see students edit out any errors that are in their labs and make them look as swish-bang as possible so that you can get marks and stuff for them. Okay, now you should set the console password. to prevent unauthorized access. Well, that's pretty straightforward, but we have to say it anyway, because somebody could run along with a console cable and plug it into the RJ45 connector and plug the other end into the serial port of their PC. Now, if you do not have a serial... If your PC does not have a serial port, thank you, Mr. Erickson, you will need a USB to serial adapter. And you can get them off eBay. This is if you are configuring routers in a work situation. However, because we don't expect people to buy anything much, you can use... Topaz obviously likes my lectures. He's asleep already. You can use SSH and TerraTerm to access the remote bundle, and you will be able to... do that. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention to people is, as far as I know, the remote bundle at Curtin is still functional. Has anybody logged onto the remote bundle on Curtin and had a look? Ah, yes, the remote bundle is up at Curtin. And there's an accessing the remote bundle, using the remote bundle.txt .doc in the documentation section of the website, and you can actually log in and play with TerraTerm, and that's a good way to make sure your TerraTerm works before you cut your teeth on the actual bundle that we're going to have running here. So there you go, Scott, you've got something to test it with in the next week or two.
Good. I'll have a play.
And you connect to the remote bundle with Telnet. That's Telnet. Connect with Telnet. Connecting with Telnet, Telnet, Telnet. Not SSH, which is the default. Telnet. Otherwise, it doesn't work and people go, the remote bundle is down. So just be aware of that. It would have cost us $400 more to get a switch with SSH on it, although ironically enough, if we'd been able to put a Linux box in, which we couldn't because of security, it wouldn't have cost us anything. So that's the way these things work.
I guess. It's just a shame, because it would have been a lot easier.
Well, the other advantage of SSH is you can enable compression, and over low bandwidth links, that makes a big difference, especially if you've got cruddy internet.
I had someone connect to me with SSH with a 56K dial-up connection. It took hours.
Well, if they actually turned on compression, you can actually get about 10, 15 kilobytes a second over a 56K modem, which isn't too shabby. Okay, now once you have set the console password, which you do in line configuration mode, and there are labs that show you how to do that, you need to also set the VTY passwords. Does anybody know what the VTY passwords are used for? Anybody got any idea? It doesn't actually say in the notes, so you're not going to get in trouble if you don't know. The VTY password is for when you telnet or SSH into the router. VTY means virtual TTY. And TTY is short for teletype, I think. Yes, excellent. I wasn't making it up. And if you have seen teletypes, you've obviously been watching too many 1960s and 70s movies, okay? So we won't go into that. Or you're in the army when they use them. There we go. Which was probably up until about a year or two ago. Well, they probably still worked. Okay. Now, remember I said when you are configuring interfaces, the DCE, or the data communications equipment, has the clock set. The DCE has the clock set. The DCE has the clock set. The DCE has the clock set. C is for clock. The DCE has the clock set. This is very important, because when you have to set the router, the DCE has the clock set, okay? The clock tells it how fast it is going to send the data over the link. So can anybody tell me who usually sets the clock rate? Don't say the DCE, we know that, but which entity usually sets the clock rate? And we have a local answer from Grace, which is correct, so you could mic up and say that.
ISP.
That's correct. The ISP sets the clock rate. The more money you pay them, the higher they set the clock rate. Very simple. And the more data you can download. However, if you are responsible for configuring Cisco routers at an ISP, or you're actually responsible for configuring both ends of a Cisco data connection, it may be up to you to set the clock rate. And in fact, when you configure things on the remote bundle, you will actually set the clock rate. So that's all good. Okay, when you're talking about interface names, you have controller number, slot number, and interface number on the newer routers. So, for example, you have serial 0/0/0, which, would you believe, is controller number 0, slot 0, interface number 0. If the thing is in slot 1, it's 0/1/0. Okay, that will make a lot more sense once you're actually on the router and you're actually doing it. You have the controller ID and the port ID. So, for example, fast Ethernet 0/0, fast Ethernet 1/0. Last week we talked about configuring the default route, and that's important, otherwise your setup has no way for traffic to leave the network. Any questions so far? And do keep in mind that this will make a lot more sense once you're doing the labs. That's the way to really get your hands dirty in this stuff and get some practice in. I'm not particularly fussed with the Discovery 2 labs, but they're better than nothing, and we'll do all of them, and it should give you some practice. I preferred the old CSNA2 labs a lot more. There were more of them, and we did have students sort of pulling out their hair, but it did teach you a lot about how to get in and out of the various configuration modes and stuff on the routers. Now, the other thing that's worth mentioning is, at the moment, there is a simulation tool that a lot of Cypher people use because their academies don't have the budget for the amount of Cisco gear that we have, or they didn't get given as much Cisco gear as we have, and they use a thing called Packet Tracer, which is a simulation tool that allows you to draw up a network topology and put routers and switches and workstations and stuff on that topology. Work is currently underway to make Packet Tracer somewhat accessible.
I saw a note that they released a new one that's supposed to have accessibility improvements. I don't know what kind, but that's what I saw a couple weeks ago.
I can hardly hear you.
Yeah, 5.1, yeah. I just wonder how they're going to go about it because it's just so graphical.
I think that we're going to work on a way of actually SSHing in.
Oh, that'd be cool. So not unlike the way we do it.
Yeah, pretty much. Can you just up your microphone level, or did you already do that?
Well, it's out now. Supposedly, it's supposed to have some accessibility improvements. So I don't know what that's about, but it's out.
A little bit. Just check your level in the control panel. We know that they're still working on it because we're involved with them. So it may have some accessibility improvements, so it might be worth taking a look at the new one, although we are looking at a way of actually having a way where you actually SSH in and you can talk to the underlying interface and stuff. Hang on a second, Scott, I'll rat it up for you, because other students will want to know. Okay.
Well, I could have missed it, but I looked in general instructions and looked like everything else there.
Okay. It might be down the bottom under updated, accessing the remote bundle.
I'll have a look. But the last thing, there were some turn notes and VMware info.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, y'all.
Good, whatever to you. Jackie.
Hi, Jackie.
Whatever time zone you happen to be in.
Mr. Hoth, you and I need to have a conversation.
We can, after lecture. We're in the middle of Discovery 2, Module 6, and I'd be happy to have a conversation with you after lecture, if that would suit.
Wonderbar.
Excellent. Okay. Now, looks like it's probably lurking, so this could be my problem. It is on there. And I will move it somewhere where you can all find it much more easily.
So it's there, we just can't see.
No, it isn't actually. It's actually in the CCNA section. You go to the old CCNA2 section.
Yeah,
it's there. So
right.
We'll move it into Discovery as well. We'll copy that one in. It's down the bottom of the student resources page. So we'll make that much easier to find. So that's all good.
I just didn't look there because I didn't think we weren't doing that one.
Well, there's actually lots of good information in there, and there's actually some very good lectures done by yours truly. And some not-so-good lectures done by yours truly. I'll move that into... that's a hidden URL. We talked about that last week.
I'll catch you folks in about half an hour.
Enjoy your lunch, Leon.
Thanks, Kerry, I will.
Alrighty, so yeah, we'll move that one. So thank you for spotting that, Scott. We will fix that. It's probably worth either symlinking or moving that file. I think Apache's set to follow symlinks, so we might just symlink it. Okay, you can configure DHCP server from the CLI. And there are only 8 basic steps, which is why everybody just goes and sets up a real DHCP rather than using the Cisco router. That's not true. The Cisco router one isn't too bad. But if you have significant DHCP requirements, you probably want to set up either one of your Windows boxes, one of your Windows server boxes, or one of your Linux boxes, or two of your Linux boxes, as DHCP servers. However, it is possible on small Soho networks to set up the Cisco router as a DHCP server. Now, interestingly enough, I went looking for a piece of Windows software that would work under Windows XP and provide DHCP server functions that wasn't internet connection sharing. $995. Thank you very much. It's almost... I actually ended up building a Linux virtual machine to do it. That's how impressed with that price I was. And that was like for a 5 years of license. You had to pay more if you wanted it to hand out more than 5 or 10 IP addresses. I was just in shock. Just like, this is not cool.
That's amazing.
Was it actually accessible, though? That's the question.
Oh, I didn't even try.
It was probably a 10-minute demo.
Yeah, with lease lengths of a minute or something. But yeah, I realise I'm a bit of an evangelist, but I mean, if you really want to run DHCP services and stuff, get Linux or a Mac or one of the other free Unixes. They are really a good bit of kit. I know Scott has dabbled with Linux in the past and has had quite a lot of fun with it.
And quite a lot of not so fun with it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, there are people who do have quite a lot of not so fun with it. But there is actually a blind admins list, and there are some good resources for getting help with Linux. And then there's some not good resources like my Skype number and stuff. But I don't tend to answer too many Linux questions because you get a lot of people asking you. But if you're configuring DHCP from the CLI, there are 8 basic steps. It's like an 8-step program. Create a DHCP address pool. That's a good idea, so it knows where it's allocating the DHCP addresses from. Specify the network and the subnet. That's important too, because otherwise it really doesn't know what it's doing. Exclude specific IP addresses. Can anybody tell me why you'd want to exclude specific IP addresses from DHCP allocation?
You don't want your loopback address or anything like that.
That's true, although there's another reason why you'd exclude certain addresses.
Networking and broadcast addresses?
No, it's pretty smart enough to exclude those by itself, generally, unless you've got a really brain-damaged DHCP server.
What about restricted, if you want restricted access to certain ones?
No. This one's really simple, guys. Everybody's thinking too complex. What about if you had statically assigned devices like servers and printers and you don't want those as addresses rehanded out by the DHCP stuff?
Yeah.
And this is very important, and I'm going to say this about 5 times. Okay, so here we go. Only have one DHCP server on your network active unless you know what you are doing. Only have one DHCP server active on your network at once unless you know what you're doing. Okay? Only have one DHCP server active on your network unless you know what you're doing. Well, guess what people do? They buy like a router, like an ADSL router or whatever, or a cable router or whatever, and then they plug in... they plug it in, and they plug all their 2 PCs into it, and then they decide they're going to go wireless. So they buy themselves a wireless router, and then they plug the wireless router into the cable router, and they have 2 DHCP servers active on 2 different subnets, and they wonder why stuff doesn't work. Now, we've all been through Discovery 1, What would happen if a DHCP server handed out an IP address that wasn't on the same subnet as the default gateway? Anybody tell me?
I can. I've done this before. you won't be able to get on the internet.
Exactly. I had the very same problem Friday night.
Ah, good job.
Now, just out of enjoyment, we'll digress a little bit here. Can anybody tell me, does anybody know why it is a problem to have two active DHCP servers on the one subnet? The technical reason why it causes grief.
Well, they're both trying to, they're both trying to do the same thing.
They are. When you send out a discover request, which is a thing that says I am, and it gives the MAC address, and it puts as a host name in the packet, it actually sends a broadcast to 255.255.255.255. Can anybody tell me what broadcast address that is?
It's your broadcast address.
No, not quite. Anybody come up across 255.255.255.255 before?
Sounds like a subnet mask.
No, it's actually it's the non-network specific broadcast. In other words, it's the general broadcast address for any network. So if you broadcast to that, it'll go out to all connected devices regardless of what their IP address is set to, because it's the non-specific network broadcast. It's a bit like, going out into... It's just going out somewhere and just yelling as loud as you can to everybody you can. But basically, the discover request goes out from a PC and it goes to the network, non-specific network broadcast address 255.255.255.255. Now, this brings up an interesting firewalling problem, which isn't covered in your notes. If you have devices between you and the DHCP server that block the non-network specific broadcast, it will actually, generally speaking, stop DHCP from working. And that's not very cool. Okay, now what I'm going to do, and I know you're all not going to like me for this, but I'm going to look at, in the next week or two, writing up a little lab that gets you to fire up some Linux virtual machines and stuff and actually see how DHCP functions and operates. And that'll be more work.
Might be good to know, at least, yeah. I agree with him.
Yeah, I think that'd be really useful.
Okay. And what we're going to do is we're going to actually get you to fire up a couple of the Debian virtual machines and get fire one up as a client and one up as a server. And we're going to let you use host-only networking so that you don't put two DHCP servers on your one network like Grace and Jackie did.
Oh, wait. That's a minute. Okay. Don't blame me. That was
I've
Holiday
Inn
that did that, and I had a default gateway in my... TCP IP, so it wasn't quite me.
Oh, okay, fair enough. A situation in which Jackie found herself, which was the fault of the Holiday Inn. That's okay. We are not questioning your competence. I have put two DHCP servers on the one network from time to time, and I will not use the language with which I discovered this problem and subsequently fixed it. Suffice it to say that I was unimpressed by the situation.
It was pastoral language.
It was. And what happened, actually, we had a situation where I think Chris, we all know Chris Legg, and I might as well tell the story because he actually did a good job with this one. He went to this real estate agent, and they'd actually got two routers and wired them together by their LAN ports, and they had a wireless router and a DSL router. And basically, when you fired up a PC, it was hit and miss as to which one would actually respond to the DHCP request first, as to which one would actually assign an IP address. So what the computer technicians were doing is, when everybody shut the computers down and booted them back up and they got allocated the wrong IP addresses, they were actually charging this company $100 a shot to send out a technician to fix it.
Oh, good one. Yeah, that's painful.
Very nasty.
Yeah, just a
was
bit.
That per machine or
no? That was just per incident.
Wow.
It happened every couple of days, and they were paying it.
Really? Oh, it just shows you how, you know, some people just, you know, they try, but they just don't understand.
Well, the other problem is, of course, is there's bush technicians and dodgy people in every industry, and there's con merchants in the IT industry as well. And I think you can certainly be taken for a ride by people who want to know, you know, who want their stuff fixed, and people pay it because they're in a business, and whatever it is, I mean, oh well, if it costs $300, then that must be what it costs. And unfortunately, people either find due to time considerations or because their friend's cousin recommended this mob or whatever, they don't go around and get three quotes. And this can result in them being highly overcharged.
I think my favourite was somebody who got charged $180 to have Windows installed and took a day.
Wow.
That was a shop.
What do I usually I charge about $60 to $80 to install Windows, to be fair, because by the time you load all, that's with all the drivers and stuff, drivers and updates, and that's a full package.
Oh, this was just Windows and the default CD drivers.
Oh,
ridiculous!
Yeah, wow. Well, I actually got told by our local computer shop, because we used to charge $20 an hour for computer work, and we were told to put our prices up to $50, or we'd be put out of business. So we put our prices up.
Well, over in the States, there's a guy named P.T. Barnum, and he used to say that there's a sucker born every minute.
That's exactly right. And in IT, they're every 30 seconds. Basically, there's a lot of people who do get taken for a ride. And whilst this isn't the nicest thing to do, the other thing you can also do is, if you don't really want to do a job, however you have the ability to do it, price it at the price that you can be bothered doing the job at, and then if somebody doesn't want to pay it, they can always go somewhere else. Now, that's not a very ethical thing to do, but there you have it, and I've had to do that on occasion. There have been jobs I haven't really wanted to do, and I've said $100 an hour, and they've paid it. So, you know, I suddenly decided I wanted to do those jobs.
I've had that. Yeah.
It's up to them to do their research.
To a degree, but if you're in a place that is a very clicky community like Perth, or you've got word of mouth and stuff in Melbourne and all that sort of stuff, or anywhere really, if you get yourself a bad reputation, it'll finish you. And if you charge people $200 an hour to teach them how to alt tab, for example, you may get a very bad...
Wow.
I could just imagine you sitting there going, now, come on, it's just two keys.
No, Scott, I would sit there and go, now, you hold down the alt key. All right, now, have we got the alt
That's
key
$100?
Down?
Checking that you've got...
Yeah.
It's amazing how the concept is new people, though, you know. It's almost like telling people how to walk.
Actually, it is really, really hard for a lot of blind people.
And you'd be surprised,
I've actually talked to a few people.
Has anybody ever considered that the fact that you've actually got to hold one key down and keep pressing the other key, and keeping the original key held down and then releasing both of them, that is not an easy thing to do, generally speaking. Your fingers, I mean, you learn to do it soon enough when you have to, but your fingers don't like to do that, generally. It's like patting your head and rubbing your tummy.
I don't know, I have some pretty bad coordination problems, and I've always been able to do it.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's also hard because, you know, the people who you meet, like, I was teaching somebody to do it, you know, to use a particular device the other day, and he's only got one hand that works. And I was thinking, like, how's he going to do this? I mean, he figured out his own way, but it's not the way I do it, but it works. You know, if it works for them, great.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll try not to wander off too much off the path here, but all very interesting stuff. But it is very difficult to teach somebody how to alt-tab, and some people honestly do not have the coordination. I know people who go into a spin if their keyboards don't have right control and alt keys. That's, you know, break out the champagne, because we need cheering up. I've only ever used the left hand. Yeah, pretty much. Although I think the laptops usually have a right... alt, but they don't have the right control. Yeah.
Actually, I have both.
What's your Win got? Any idea?
Both.
No.
Okay.
Mine certainly got one.
Mine sure does. Both alt and control.
I think the AAA has two.
No. I'm looking at my AAA right here, and it's only got one control key. It's got two shift keys, two alt keys.
Two control keys?
Yeah, I know it's got two controls, because Geraldine uses the right control for...
1000H has got the both the controls.
I don't know, maybe you're right. Maybe I just haven't worked out what this key does here.
It's very easy because of the keyboard layer to think it's probably the left arrow key or something, because it's probably right next to it.
That's right.
Okay,
I
just
use my NC10
a lot. Yeah, just for people who do want to actually work out what keys they do and don't have off lecture, you can hit Jaws key plus one if you're running Jaws. Is it Jaws key plus one?
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Doesn't speak.
And that turns on.
Training mode.
And then you can hold down the modifier key and press another key, and it'll say Alt plus T or whatever, and you'll know what it is that way.
And Jaws key one to get back out of it, I think, from memory.
Yes, it is. Jaws key plus one to get back out of it. And before we leave this topic, I actually saw a thing called the Happy Hacker keyboard, and it's actually a keyboard that will plug into just about anything, Apples, PCs, Sparks, laptops, whatever you want, and it's got USB and PS2 and Spark and Apple and all that sort of good stuff, and it's actually a consistent keyboard to be used on all devices, and some people find that kind of cool.
Is it pretty portable?
Yes.
Yeah, is it one of those roll-up USB keyboards?
That's not quite roll-up, but it is actually about the width of the regular set of keys minus the number pad stuff, but it does overlay the number pad onto JKL UIO like the laptops do. A lot of Jaws users tell me that they can't do XYZ because they don't have a number pad, and I say you can't do XYZ because you haven't learnt to hold the FN down with your little finger and press JKL, and that can be quite handy if there are numpad specific commands, especially in something like WindowEyes, or you can go out to your local shop and buy a USB number pad, which makes life a bit easier too.
Also, Jaws laptop layout is phenomenal.
Although there are actually things, say, for example, SpeakUp's now got a laptop layout, but there are actually some screen readers that specifically use the number pad, and you need to use the number pad keys, which is interesting. And there are also some programs that differentiate between the inverted T and the number pad, and that's not cool. So be aware of that, and know how to turn it on and off if you need to. Okay, back to the lecture. We're setting up a DHCP server. We were excluding specific IP addresses. We were specifying the domain name as step 4. So mycompany.com, just to be really, boring. Or example.org. I think there is actually an example.org, actually. Now you specify the IP address of the DNS server. Why do we specify the IP address of the DNS server?
Because it
so you can look
DNS
up DNS
itself.
Addresses.
Well done, and the Americans have it today. You can't look up DNS servers, so you're going to www.nowhere.net very fast. Okay, so make sure you have your DNS servers configured. Now, this is an interesting thing. I've actually seen this happen on a couple of things. This is something to be aware of. Sometimes, and I have no idea why, but sometimes when you connect to your DSL service, your computer does not get assigned DNS server addresses. And when that happens, you actually need to... And the way you can tell this is happening, interestingly enough, is if you launch Skype and it works, and you launch your web browser and it doesn't, you don't have any DNS support, because Skype doesn't actually require DNS support.
Saw it happen with Avon just the other day.
Usually you go into your router status page and you hit disconnect and you hit reconnect.
Yeah,
and people usually go, but why does this happen? And you go, because it does.
It's pretty much what I said to her. And it's also happened to me, too. She was really only getting pages out of her cache because she wasn't really getting the pages at all, and her Skype was working very nicely.
And that's how you heard about it, assumedly.
You know, I have my DSL router set to static DNS, and I use opendns.org, and I've never had that problem.
No, you won't, because you've got yours set to static DNS and you're using opendns.com. However, I had some funnies with OpenDNS a while back when you used to go to m.facebook.com in Firefox and OpenDNS would send you somewhere strange. And I never quite figured out what was going on there. The other problem with OpenDNS, and just be aware of this, and it's the design of OpenDNS, is when you do a query for anything, like any site, so if you do a query for abcdefjkl.org, it will always return a positive response with one of their name servers so that your web browser can be redirected to their error page unless you turn that functionality off. So if you are using OpenDNS, and I would strongly suggest that people do use OpenDNS because it does help you avoid anti-phishing sites and things, there are probably two or three things you should do. One, set up an account. It's free. I really would recommend this because you can do a couple of things. You can actually look at the statistics of all your DNS queries and see where everybody went. You can also track how much OpenDNS usage you're having. You can also do things like block Facebook and YouTube, which is always good if you're in a work situation, or various other sites. Turn on and off your anti-phishing protection. The second thing you should do is point your DSL router at the DNS, OpenDNS servers, not every individual PC. Because if you point every individual PC at OpenDNS, you will never have a chance for your router to cache DNS requests. And that's not particularly cool because it will have to go out and look them up to the internet every time.
Gee, I've done all those things.
Well done. So that's all cool. We're using OpenDNS at home, just so that people know. I use OpenDNS. It does work exceedingly well, and it's a very popular service. So, OpenDNS, yeah.
Yes, I've got my son-in-law quite mad at me because I've blocked his file share downloading from OpenDNS.
Save yourself from all the virus.
Mm-hmm. You certainly do. And those sorts of things. So you can block and unblock various things, and that can be useful in certain situations. We actually share internet with our next door neighbour, and I think that if I blocked Facebook, she'd be a very unhappy person because that's all she ever does on the net. She watches videos off Slide Fun Space.
I'd be worried about sharing my internet with, you know, someone next door. I'd always want to know what they're accessing, but I want to have a pretty good idea of their, you know, more than monitor it.
I already do. She goes through my proxy server.
Yeah, turns off at midnight.
No.
And doesn't turn on until 9 a.m.
That's right. No, she actually goes through my proxy server. And one of the stipulations say was that I was responsible for that internet account and that I would need to know where she went and that my proxy server did log that. I said I would very rarely look at where she went, but to be aware that there could be the possibility that I would check where she had been on various occasions. And I wouldn't give her access to my internet without agreeing to those conditions, which I wrote down on a piece of paper and had her sign.
Perfect.
Okay, sorry, back to the lecture. Step 6, set the default gateway. That's important, otherwise your packets will never get out. They will be trapped. Set the lease duration. I believe the default on Cisco is 1 day, or 86,400 seconds, which is one of those stupid numbers that you see so often in computing that you remember, that 86,400 is 1 day. Yeah, that's right, 60 by 60 by 24. 3,600 seconds in an hour. All sorts of good things like that. No, that's not right, 3,600 seconds in an hour. That's better. And you end up seeing these numbers all over the place because you see them in DNS, for example, 604,800 seconds in a week, because that's what a lot of the maximum time to live records are set for in DNS. And step 8 is verify the configuration. That's always a good one. You don't want your DNS server dying horribly. Or handing out the wrong information. A DHCP server handing out the wrong information can be even worse than no DHCP server at all. Okay. Any questions about any of that? Alrighty, now we're talking about setting up static NAT. Now, can anybody tell me what static NAT is? Does anybody know?
I think so.
Well, you can have a go if you want.
Isn't that the IP address? It translates your private IP addresses into one public IP address?
It translates one private IP address into one public IP address. What you're talking about is dynamic NAT, which is where you hide everything behind one IP address. Cisco refers to that as overloading, because you're overloading the one IP address with a whole lot of other traffic. So static NAT is where you transfer, you know, 192.168.40.5 into 203.161.40.5 or whatever, and you have an internal to external mapping for your network address translation. Okay, there are 8 steps for doing that according to the notes. Specify the inside interface. The inside interface is the inside interface. It's inside your network. It's the one that the machines on your network are going to connect to. Set the primary IP address of the inside interface. This is a good idea because you don't want the router or the NAT device moving around on your subnet. Which is why it's always a good idea to statically allocate servers, printers, and other things that you don't want their IP addresses floating around, or map the MAC addresses of your devices permanently to IP addresses in your DHCP service configuration file, if you have such a beast. Many routers will allow you to do hard mappings between IP addresses and MAC addresses, and in fact a lot of routers will actually let you set up a MAC address filter on definitely the wireless, but also sometimes the Ethernet, so that you can only have a certain subset of machines that are actually allowed to connect onto your network. And if you're the security conscious type, that can certainly cut down a lot of instances of war driving, along with all of the other wireless security things that you will need to do. Step 3 is to identify the inside interface using the ipnat inside command. Specify the outside interface is step 4. That's important. Which one is actually going to connect to the internet? Set the primary interface, primary IP address of the outside interface, unless it is assigned by your internet service provider. Identify the outside interface using the ipnat outside command. And then you define the static address translation as step 7, and verify the configuration and make sure it all works. Show NAT translations will show you what translations are in effect. Dynamic translations are around for 24 hours by default, otherwise they will be cleared after that. They can be cleared earlier.
Kira.
Yes, that's on a Cisco router.
Sorry, what does it mean to define the static NAT translation in step 7? What does that mean?
You map 192.168.4.5 to 203.161.4.5. You actually map one internal private IP address to one external publicly routable IP address. That's assuming you have a pool of them. So the normal home user wouldn't be doing this. It's only if you've been allocated more than one IPv4 address by your internet service provider.
But, sorry, but didn't you really do that with all of the other steps involved, like 1 through 6?
No, you only specified the internal interface, the external interface, the internal IP address of the internal interface, the external IP of the external interface. You haven't yet told the router to do any NATing whatsoever. So you end up basically setting up all this stuff, the internal NAT interface, the external stuff, the external NAT interface, and then you actually have to execute a command to go, all right, NAT that.
We get a lab to do this, right?
Yes, you do. There is a lab where you do this. It's devilishly complicated because they want you to do it with SDM, which is essentially inaccessible but very easy to use, and we want you to do it from the CLI, but it is doable. So we'll be providing some nifty hints to show you how to do that, and you will need that 8-step process to do it. Okay. Now, one of the questions I'm probably going to be asked is, oh boy, Looking at the nearest bridge, how do I remember all of these Cisco configuration commands? And I say, well, don't worry about the nearest bridge. There is what we call Ciscopedia. And Ciscopedia is a big help file that has a quick reference to all of the commands. And I would strongly suggest that people download the Ciscopedia and install it. It's a Windows help file, and they can use that to refer to all of those commands that they really can't remember, because I certainly don't remember them all. I refer to Ciscopedia. So certainly keep that in mind. We don't expect you to be super duper remember everything. We want you to remember general procedures and things on how to do this. Obviously, the more you were to work with it, the better at it you would get. Any questions on any of that so far?
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Look, we, as I said, you guys haven't got your hands dirty on the remote bundle yet, so don't panic too much. There's still plenty of time to get all of the labs and stuff done, and we will be working on getting that functional very soon. In fact, today I'm just about to have a fist fight with OpenVPN and see if I can get it to talk to the two network segments.
Now, that should be entertaining to watch, guys.
Sadly, so record it and stick it up on them.
On Blind Cool
Addition
Tech.
To lecture.
Could you imagine if somebody did a Blind Cool Tech on how to configure a Cisco router? I don't think there'd be too many people that would download that one to
that
have a listen.
That would be hilarious.
Oh, we would. We would.
We'd be about the only ones, probably.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, one of the things you should probably know about router configuration files, and this may either make you very happy or it may make you very sad, it makes me very happy, is their text files. You know what you can do with the text files, people? You can edit them in Notepad.
Yay.
Okay, this is good. Yes, and in fact, you can assemble your router configuration in Notepad, or you can actually grab your router configuration in Notepad, hack it around a bit, and then send it back to the router. And this is a very good thing. It disturbs me how many consumer-grade routers dump these stupid binary configuration files that you can't look at. And one of the good things about Cisco is because it uses text-based configuration files, you can actually look through the whole configuration file, preferably with a Braille display if you happen to have one, but if you don't, it's the world's smallest violin
Talk
here
to
playing.
Me.
yeah, because he'll sell you one, yeah.
Well, I've got four, I'll just, you know.
So, yeah, you've got, one for each hand and one for each foot, huh?
Yeah, they're all covered.
Yeah, fair enough. So what's actually happening is, so if you do have a Braille display, you can use that, and that makes life a lot easier. And some Braille displays work better with various screen access solutions than others. Now, interestingly enough, I heard rumours that NVDA had some sort of Braille support, but I've never seen it. Has anybody seen that work?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it works. Yeah, it's fine. I got it working. With the Brailleant and the Braille Connect, they work fine.
Ah, excellent. I'll just have to go look through the menus and actually set it up. But,
You know, you've got to install BRLTTY.
Aha! That would be why it doesn't work.
Yeah, once you've installed that, it'll all show up in the menu.
Excellent. Now, for anybody who doesn't know, BRLTTY, and there is a port to Windows, is a utility that provides Braille and, under Linux, speech access to the Linux console. And I think it can even do talky stuff under Windows too, but I've never tried.
No, I just stick to the Braille.
Yeah, but it's designed for accessing shells and stuff, so it's kind of cool. It gives you Braille access to the shell, and it's very nice. And it's written by a guy called Dave Milk or something. I'm not sure how you pronounce his name.
Milky.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, so that's how you do Braille the Milky Way. Now, okay. Let's move on, shall we? You can copy config files to a TF... Yes, certainly. you can copy Braille... I thought that was pretty good. I'm probably the only one. Files to a TFTP server. And you do that by going copy space startup space TFTP, and it will prompt you for the IP address and various path information of the TFTP server. Can anybody tell me what TFTP stands for?
Trivial File Transfer Protocol.
Well done. And it's a UDP-based protocol that is used for sending and receiving simple file transfers, or trivial ones, if you like, to and from routers and other devices.
It's very fast.
Yeah. Oh, it can be, but it can also be very slow, depending on how reliable your network is, because there is very little error checking and correction. It's pretty much fire and forget. Now, there's something to be aware of with TFTP, and it's actually a security consideration under Linux, and a lot of the Windows ones don't have this limitation. You must actually create a zero-length file on the server before you can push a file of that name to the server if you're using a Linux-based TFTP server, because if you don't, the TFTP server will not just gratuitously create files unless they've already been created by an administrator, because otherwise you could have a denial of service attack thing where rogue clients could upload megabytes and megabytes of files to the TFTP server. Just a little wrinkle for you to be aware of. So we'll try and make sure we nullify that, and we'll turn off all the security so you don't have to do that. But if you find that you can't push a file to the Linux-based TFTP service, you will find that you have to actually touch the file, and we'll give you instructions on how to do that. Now, this is another one that may cause the blood pressure to go up a bit. I'm going to tell you all now that the workstations that you will be using on the remote bundle are all Linux. So they're all Linux, and you'll be working from the Linux command line with them. And the reason we're doing that is because that is one of the best operating systems to give you complete access to whatever's going on inside the operating system, whereas it would cost us several $1,000s to get enough Windows licenses, and then probably several $20,000-$30,000 to get enough screen reader licenses to be able to do the whole kit and caboodle under Windows.
Okay, so not a problem. Can you give us some instructions as to where we can go and get some materials so that we can look at what we need to be doing?
I will certainly do that. We do actually have some instructions embedded in the Using Remote Bundle documentation that will show you how to ifconfig and route and all those sorts of things on the different interfaces, and we'll show you how to do that. So. And we'll give you plenty of time to complete your labs and stuff. That won't be an issue. But we realize it is sort of a double whammy that you are sort of doing Cisco and you are sort of doing Linux. But unfortunately, our budget concern means that we need to have an operating system that is free. We are actually going to set up what we call OpenVPN access into the bundle. And that will allow you, where possible and when configured, to actually use the web interfaces on various things such as Linksys routers and stuff over the OpenVPN connection, like you would as if you were sitting on the network and you're actually working there. Okay.
You know, it doesn't bother me. I've been looking for some good materials on Linux anyway, so.
That's a really tricky one, because actually finding good materials on Linux is a bit of a challenge. There's plenty of it out there, but it's a case of getting the wheat out of the chaff, to be honest. We'll certainly point out resources that we've come across, and if anybody comes across any good Linux resources, they can certainly point them out. I seem to remember the Debian user's guide was pretty good, and so is the Ubuntu... There's a Ubuntu user's guide which also has basic chapters and stuff on introduction to shell and stuff. And the boxes that we will be configuring on the remote bundle are Ubuntu Linux boxes. So we'll be setting those up and getting those up and running. And we'll certainly look for good resources on that. You won't need to know any more than about 10 or 15 commands to generally do the labs that you want to do. It's only if you decide that you want to get right into this that you can start learning about more commands, and we'll certainly try and find you some more information on that. There are sites such as linuxquestions.org, but I've personally found that trawling through the forums is very time-consuming, so the books tend to be a better option.
Let's get you started on some of the commands, Linux command directory.
Ah, thank you for that. That's in the chat window, everybody. So if you want to cut and paste that out, that will all work quite well.
I've looked a few of these up in my earlier days, and just to get a bit of a description of what they do. And of course, there's always man pages for a lot of things once you are logged in.
Yes, and I'm not a nasty enough administrator to actually delete all the man pages off the virtual boxes to save space. I'm nice enough to leave them around.
That would just be cruel.
People do it to conserve space.
Yeah, it's all about space these days rather than quality.
Pretty much, but yeah, we'll be leaving them there. We've got plenty of disk space to be able to do that. To give you some idea, a standard Ubuntu server system installs in about 800 mega disk space. There are smaller systems you can install, obviously. Things like Linux from scratch is much smaller. GRML is quite big. Although, to be fair, at the price of thumb drives, you can get a 2 gig thumb drive pretty cheap. So, and Leon has connected, so there we go, she's back. Now, you can also capture the running config by turning your logging support on, doing a show running-config, and then editing out the more and that lines from the running config, which is something that you can then do, and then you can then and then you also take the you add no shutdown to the end of each interface description, because it actually leaves the interfaces shut down. It actually puts a shutdown command to stop you from inadvertently bringing up interfaces, so you have to take those lines out. You press space when the more prompt appears, and that gives you another screenful. And you also remove the extra text like building configuration file and all that sort of good stuff, and then you can re-inject it back into the router. Now, CPE, in case you ever wanted to know, stands for Customer Premises Equipment. And, in fact, if you're looking at ADSL connections, you can often see CPE rate and DCE rate, and it's worth knowing what CPE is. You need to plan the installation of the new router because it will disrupt the new network. No packets are going to go out and in while you're switching in a router. Do not do it at 10 o'clock in the morning while everybody's working on things. Plan it on paper or in your computer before you undertake the installation. Create a configuration checklist and use it. Make sure all the items are present before you deliver it to the customer, because there's nothing more embarrassing than finding out that curly wiggly thing is missing and you need it to actually set the thing up. And calling it a curly wiggly thing isn't going to impress them much either. Make sure you know the right names for things. And you get them to sign off on the checklist too, to make sure everything turned up, because you don't want them losing stuff. Keep your documentation up to date. Yes, we all hate doing it, but we are going to keep the documentation up to date. Check the function of the router. Customer verifies the checklist as well. And once you're all signed off, you bill them, which is Elisa's favourite bit. That's my favourite bit, and it's most of our technicians' favourite bit, is when you bill them. And leave a copy of the documentation with the customer and explain to them that they really, really, really should hang on to it because somebody else might need it. If the company has remote sites, the ISP might need to actually link them up, so they will need to interwork with the ISP to make that link up happen. There are three types of WAN connections. Point-to-point, that's from your ISP to your customer, or from one customer to another customer over a dedicated line. Example of those connections are T1 or E1. Switch circuit, you're looking at ISDN or dial-up. In other words, you establish the connection, the circuit is established, the data travels, you then tear down the connection, the circuit is broken. And then packet switched, where you've got multiple users sharing the same channel, you're looking at things like frame relay. Now, I will also point out that cable is a shared medium. Cable is a shared medium. Cable is a shared medium. So if all of the other kids on your block are torrenting, you're going to get pretty lousy network speeds. Unless, of course, you are lucky enough to live out where Grace's dad lives and you're at the end of the cable and nobody else is on it, and then you get really high speeds. Well, actually, it's optical fiber, but yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty beautiful.
Speed and bandwidth, in other words, how fast does the connection go, how much data can it carry, and the price. And believe it or not, the bigger, the higher the speed, and the more bandwidth, the more you pay. If the business provides services over a WAN link, it might need higher upstream bandwidth. So, for example, if you're serving out websites, or serving out other content, or your employees regularly email out 10 meg spreadsheets every 10 minutes, you probably want high bandwidth. Has anybody ever noticed, and I realise there's a Microsoft wizard that's supposed to protect you from this, that there are a lot of people who suddenly grab about 10 photos from their digital camera at 5 megapixels, attach them to an email, and then wonder why their 35 meg message won't go out?
Oh yeah, done it.
Oh yeah, I got a message from somebody the other day, it was 26 meg full of photos. I wrote back to him and said, are you serious? I can't read them. He said, oh, sorry.
And there is actually a Microsoft picture and whatever wizard that will actually munge your pictures down to a regular size so that you can email them. It basically JPEGs them on incredibly aggressive settings, and we hope they look all right. They probably do, but obviously if you can't see, you've got no guarantee, so you just do it and hope for the best. Or you can install, as I said, a thing called Image Magic, ImageMagik, which is on www.imagemagic.org, which is...
No, it isn't.
Isn't it?
Link's busted, sir.
Ah, right.
Amazing.
Okay, well, you Google up Image Magic and you'll find it. It used to be on imagemagic.org.
Maybe they could make it, who knows?
Maybe they couldn't afford the domain, I don't know. Actually, it might be on imagemagic.sourceforge.net, but we'll Google that up and we'll find out where that is. And thank you for bringing that to my attention.
I've just done it. I've placed it in it.
Ah, no worries.
It's right
excellent.
Here.
You haven't pasted it in yet,
though? Never mind.
Okay. You better paste it in anyway, Scott. That's all right. And you can image imagine them down yourself. But yeah, look, I mean, you've got to be aware of what you're emailing out. There are too many people that right-click, send to, email recipient, boom, I just emailed you a CD. Believe it or not, I've seen people do it. They rip a CD into WAV files and they try and email out 600 meg. And then they wonder why Outlook Express just sits there and bogs down their whole computer or their mailer of choice as it slowly chuggers 600 meg of CDs out, only to be bounced by the receiving ISP, which has a 20 meg limit.
I found it, guys. It's magick.org.
Ah, sorry, magick.
I didn't look at the spelling, I just pasted it.
There we go, excellent. Okay.
Oh, sorry about the PHP script at the end.
That's all right. We'll manage. We've got some clever students here. Obviously, when you're setting up internet service provider links, you tell the customer what they can have, what the possibilities are, and what the actual advantages and disadvantages of those possibilities are. And this is somewhat quite difficult. This is not an easy thing to do. If you've ever tried explaining the internet and network bandwidth and stuff to a complete noob or somebody who is just not into computers, it's not an easy thing to do. A lot of people, for example, will come up to you, and I'm sure Elise has this happen about 10 times a day. I'd like a website. What sort of website? I don't know, I just want a website. With pictures and stuff.
Yes.
Wow.
Believe
me, it happens. Terry's so right.
And you're like, oh, I don't know. It's like people who come into like the department store and they go, I want an internet. Okay.
Yeah, we can send there when someone's asked that.
Yeah, I want to buy an internet. You want to buy an internet? Well, there is only one internet. Oh, well, I want one. Okay, cool. You'll need an incredible amount of money.
Very big. I think my favourite is when they say, I want it.
Yes, I want it. I want it. I want it services. Okay?
Yeah,
my company needs it.
Yeah.
IT.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Very important to be able to explain these sorts of things. But yeah, people come in and go, I want a website. What do you want on your website? I don't know. Okay, now people, you've got two options. You can either sit with me and I will charge you $60 an hour while you work it out, or you can come back to me once you've got some sort of idea and we'll work from there. Most people go for the second option, I would generally think, although some people will take the first option.
Some people take the first option because you can charge consultancy.
Exactly. And you'd like to charge consultancy, but I usually give them the choice.
Oh, I give them the choice, but...
It's good to give them the choice.
You have to consult, and sometimes you can be a little bit surreptitious and just build it in the price of what you're doing anyway. But because it can take time, and part of your job is to educate.
That is
educate
exactly
and
right.
Facilitate.
I think that was
I do that most of the time.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Interestingly enough, and good morning, Satish, I think it is. If you can just shoot me if I'm wrong.
Good morning.
Ah, good. Woo-hoo. I'm doing well today. Okay. Basically, what can happen is you can actually have. There are times when you can do this sort of consulting with the customer, and my train of thought's just been derailed. We were talking about consulting with the customer, and it's very important to do consulting. Part of your job is to educate. Yes, we had a case a couple of years back where a friend of mine was doing Photoshop work for some people, and he was charging them $120 an hour because it was quite complex artwork. And I said, well, why can't you just train us how to do that? And he sat somebody down and said, okay, so you get this image and you take it from CMYK and you put it into RGB, and then you run this convolution filter over it, and then you do a resize, and then you think we'll go back to paying $120 an hour. And that's what they did. They went back to paying $120 an hour because it really was a bit complex for these people to do. And if you are looking for a free alternative to Photoshop, and if you've got the money to buy Photoshop, or you found the money to buy Photoshop, more power to you, check out the GIMP. And I'm not even going to give out a URL. You can Google it up, except make sure you Google up the GIMP graphic image manipulation program, or you might see some websites that you don't want to see, okay?
It's now available for Windows, the GIMP. And I've got it for both Windows and Linux. It's very nice.
It's on gimp-win.sourceforge.net or something. It's actually quite a good
one. I can't remember where I got it. It runs a little bit slow on Windows on some machines, but I think that's because of what they've done to bring it across.
I think you'll find it's more... Do you use any enlargement technology with it? Because I know that Magic and Zoom Text and stuff don't track it well.
No, okay. I don't. Okay.
We must have blistering fast machines because we didn't really notice that much of a slowdown, but we sort of weren't in for screaming performance either.
Well, I do have to say it probably works better on my newer machine, so I think, if you've got a dual core or something, you probably won't actually notice it.
Okay. Now, they're talking about the different types of encapsulation that you can end up with. You can have HDLC, and you can change it to PPP if you require authentication. And a lot of ISPs do use PPP, basically so they can bill the customer on bandwidth and stuff. They can use Radius servers and all that sort of stuff to empty your wallet into theirs. If you've got a Cisco 1841, it's only got some ports on it. If you need more ports, they're recommending that you buy Cisco 2960s. They are not expandable, however, you do have to pick how many ports you want. Obviously, this course is written by Cisco, so they're going to suggest you buy Cisco. Switches work at layer 2. I think we should all know that by now.
Very expensive.
Anybody tell me what layer 2 is? Yeah, just a bit. Very reliable, though. Anyone tell me what layer 2 is?
Data link.
Yeah, you're right.
Data link.
Data link.
Yep, that's right. Yep, it is. You can configure the Cisco 2960 switches with the CLI. You can also set up all the individual ports. You can also set up the VLAN groups and all sorts of things like that. If the auto negotiation fails, it will use the speed of the remote device in half duplex mode, so if that causes you grief, set it up properly. Now, auto negotiation, of course, is the process by which most modern network devices send their speed and duplex capabilities in the pre-link pulse, which is part of the Ethernet specification, and it will actually tell the remote device at what speed and stuff to configure. And if you actually up the debug level on the driver load of a Linux Ethernet device driver module, you can actually see the auto negotiation take place, or you can run the MII tool command that will actually show you what auto negotiation took place. In other words, what were the capabilities of the device you were connected to and what speed you are running at. Not always the most useful thing to do, but occasionally absolutely essential, and I've used it over the years to find out what was really going on. Obviously, for sighted people, you can look at the colour of the link light. That's really not an option for us, so we probably do want to see what's going on with the auto negotiation. Also notice that in Windows versions XP and newer, XP 2003, Vista, that sort of thing, it will actually tell you at what speed you have connected. It won't tell you the remote device's capabilities, but there are ways of getting in and finding that out if you get the network diagnostic tools, but it's all a bit devilishly complicated. But it will show you what speed and duplex, well, it'll show you what speed at least that you are connected to the remote device at. Now, Has everybody had enough? We can stop there and go on to powering on switches next week.
I think I'm good.
It's up to you, Kerry.
Yeah, how's everyone else travelling?
Happy either way.
We'll do a little
bit. I'm travelling. You can hit me, man.
Yeah, okay, right, right. Powering up a switch. We've got some 8-step process to powering up a switch. We'll rip through that quickly. I'd like to get to the end of this module, so I'll just keep trawling on there. If you're going to fall asleep on the desk, you don't snore, so you'll be good. Okay. Okay. Check components. That's always a good one. If there are big holes in it, or you can smell smoke from when the last person plugged it in, possibly not a good idea for you to plug it in again. Connect the cables. That always helps, including the power cable, because without that, it doesn't do much. Yes, I've seen people run around troubleshooting things for 10 minutes until they realised that the PowerPoint wasn't turned on or the power cable wasn't plugged in. It's an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Power up the switch. That helps. The power LED goes green when the post is complete. You might need a light probe to actually be able to detect that. Although, if it goes amber, you ring up Cisco and go, help, my switch is busted. There are many ways to configure a switch. Some would argue with a hammer is a good one. I would advise against that. The Cisco Network Assistant, that is one way of doing it for simple configurations. Cisco Device Manager, which is also pretty cool. The Cisco iOS CLI, which is probably how you guys will be configuring them. And there's also some Cisco View Management software, which none of us can afford, and I don't know how accessible it is. Or you can configure them with SNMP. And there is actually an accessible SNMP program. I can't remember what it was called. Peter Etholf did tell us, but I'll find out which one that is and how incredibly expensive it is and see whether it's any good to us. If you're going to configure the switch over the network, it needs to have an IP address. If you're going to configure the switch over the network, it's going to need to have an IP address. This is very important. If it's going to have an IP address, you'll be able to configure it over the network. Okay? Some people really do try telnetting to their switch and it doesn't have an IP address, and you go, well, that ain't going to happen, people. Use the console port. If it doesn't, you need to initially configure it through the console port, and you guys will be working through the console port on the remote bundle. The default VLAN is VLAN 1, and it is where you configure the IP address to VLAN 1 on a switch. So you actually configure an IP address on VLAN 1 for a switch. And I will explain what VLANs are, and I'll explain later in the words of Doctor Who. And it shows you how to do it. Enable, config T, interface VLAN 1, IP address, and then the IP address, and exit. And you can also set the IP default gateway if the switch needs to talk to devices that are off subnet. And there are times when you do want to be able to configure a switch from a remote subnet. If you've got multiple subnets in the building, you may actually have to configure the default gateway on the switch into its management interface. When you are connecting a switch to a router, use a straight-through cable. When you are connecting a switch to a router, use a straight-through cable. This is in your test. When you are configuring a switch to a router, use a straight-through cable. Very important. Straight-through cable, switch to router. When you are making sure that the router and the switch have management addresses on the same subnet so that they can talk to each other. That's very important. This is if you are going the Cisco way and you've bought Cisco switches and Cisco routers because you've just won the lottery and you've got lots of money, or you are working for a client where money is no object. I always wanted to work for one of those. Okay, straight through cables from switches to PCs once it works. Well, you can run them before it works, but that won't do you much good. Now, any user can usually connect to any switch port. However, you can actually limit which MAC addresses can connect to which ports, and you can turn on what we call sticky MAC addressing. So, static configuration, you set the specific IP addresses for specific hardware addresses per port. You can actually lock MAC addresses to ports, and that can stop other people from plugging into different switch ports that they shouldn't plug into. Now, sometimes the PCs don't connect directly into the switch. What usually happens is you have cabling that runs from the switch to the patch panel, and then you have PCs that come from a wall plate through the horizontal cabling to the patch panel and then to the switch. Okay. You can have it dynamically learn them. Now, when you learn an IP address, now the default number of MACs per port is 1. On a Cisco switch, the default number of MAC addresses per port is 1. Can anybody tell me...
You can have more than one MAC address per port?
What if you were to hook another... backfired my question. I was just about to say, why would you want to assign more than one MAC address on a particular switch port? Does anybody know?
Well, what happens if you had a switch connected to it with a bunch of other PCs?
That's right. If you connect two switches together and you have a whole lot of, say, 4 or 5 PCs hanging off a little desktop switch connected into the main switch board's main switch, you would obviously see 3 or 4 MAC addresses on one port.
Oh, good point.
Now, if the switch is learning dynamic addresses and you switch, shut it down and switch it off, it forgets them, obviously. So if you set static, it'll tend to remember them in the configuration file. Now, keep in mind that these are enterprise-level switches. Your usual switch in the desktop is pretty plug-and-play, no user-serviceable parts inside. These Cisco switches are quite complicated. You can actually tie various VLANs together. You can limit port limit traffic. You can do all sorts of nifty things. Now, when you use Sticky, it learns the IP, the MAC address of the port, and it remembers it, and it stores them in the running config. If you move a PC to another port, it will actually cause a port lockout, and you actually have to clear the Sticky MAC address off that port, and it has instructions on the notes in how to do that. Also, if the same address is seen on the same VLAN, in other words, you switch your PC from one port to another, you can get a security violation, and that will lock out the port. So be aware of that. If you need that sort of security, this is stuff you need to be aware of. And there's commands that say show security port ID command to actually look at the information on how that's all set up. So if you haven't read your notes for Module 6, or if you haven't been reading your notes for Module Discovery, now would be a good time to start, because these really are condensed lecture notes. And there is a switch port access mode command, which will change the access mode on the various switches. Luckily, we don't do a lot of switch work in Discovery 2. We only show you how to power up the switch and watch the post messages, so don't panic too much. You can show the running configuration to look at which MAC addresses are assigned to which port. That can be kind of handy sometimes. Okay. You can also disable port security if you really don't need that level of complexity and you will just want things to work when you plug computers into switch ports. And some people honestly do that. If you've actually got sticky addresses or static IP addresses and you've saved the running config to the startup config and you've rebooted the switch, it'll load the startup config, which had the stuff in it from the running config, so obviously that won't clear the mapping, so be aware of that. Disable unused ports. This is probably a good security thing. If you have unused ports and you have hacker types wandering around your building, they're likely to plug things into unused ports. On Cisco switches and intelligent switches, it is a good idea to disable unused ports. It's a bit like putting those little plastic things in your PowerPoint to stop kids from sticking keys in them. Although, if you were a kid like me, you knew how to pull those plastic things out, but luckily you were smart enough not to stick the keys in the PowerPoint. Any questions on that? Okay, I'm going to stop here for the moment. Because we now go on to CDP and then we launch into Module 6. And I think we've obviously done a fair bit for today, and there's a lot of information in that lecture, and I think we'll stop it there and continue on next week. Any questions and stuff? Yes, I know I have to have a talk to you, Jackie, after lecture. However, there's something I need to take care of first, which involves wandering down the corridor. So we'll go and do that in a little bit. But any questions, issues and stuff at this stage, given that the remote bundle here will be online very soon, but the remote bundle for Curtin is online, and I will move that document into the Discovery folder and also into General Instructions. Alrighty, I'm going to stop
quick
recording.
Question?
Yep, go ahead.
It was more to do with that OpenDNS that you mentioned about an hour ago. I think I was looking away at my other computer doing my radio show. I just apart from the fact that you might have a family and you want to block particular websites and connections, what are the other advantages to using that, apart from just letting your router go to your ISP's DNS?
It's generally faster than most ISP's crummy DNS servers, and it also saves you from phishing attacks. It will pick up, if you turn on the anti-phishing protection, it will pick up bogus and fake sites and stop you from visiting them before the email even has a chance to open and hammer your Windows machine.
Oh, very good. And the account you buy, so, the account you get from that's free, you said?
For single IP addresses, it's free. And to be really tedious about this, to be honest with you, the general best way to thing is to go to www.opendns.com and click on the Why Should I Use OpenDNS link. That's how I know all this stuff. It's all there. And maybe that page will be useful for potential customers that would need to know why they might want to use OpenDNS.
I like it.
I shall try it and see if my connection speeds improve. Not that they're not the request for the web pages and lookups might improve it. Because I could always test it by hammering it into the local machine just to try it out, couldn't I? Like you said, not
absolutely.
To do.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, you can do that initially to try it out, and it actually says you go the straight dope, and it gives you the two DNS servers you feed into the control panel, and off it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty, I'm going to hit stop on this recording.